How many of you have ever been in an argument with someone? You were winning. You knew you were winning. Every rational person in the universe knew you were winning. And that person, whether it was your significant other or your mom and dad, changed the subject. Can I see your hands? Oh, look at you. Now let's reverse this. How many of you have ever been in an argument? You were losing. You knew you were losing. Everyone around you knew you were losing. And you changed the subject. Can I see your hands? All right, Cedarville is more honest than other Christian colleges I have been at. Today, I want to talk to you about a topic where people change the subject. I want to talk with you about the essential pro-life Christian. Because when it comes to the issue of abortion, men and women, we are part of a culture that wants to take the main thing and make it not the main thing, that wants to change the subject away from what really counts to something else. Now, as Christians, the Bible is very clear about the main thing. In Genesis chapter 1, we are told that human beings are made in God's image, and because they are made in God's image, we have what's called intrinsic value. We are not valuable for what we do functionally. We are valuable simply because we're human beings. Genesis 1 teaches this, that because we bear the image of God, we have value. The next thing the Bible teaches is that because we bear God's image, the shedding of innocent blood is strictly forbidden. That means you're not to intentionally kill an innocent human being. Exodus 23 teaches this. Proverbs 6 teaches this. Matthew 5 teaches this. From those two premises, that all humans bear God's value and that it's wrong to shed innocent blood because they bear his value, there's only one question to ask. Are the unborn human? Because if they are human, they too are image bearers. They too should not have their blood shed any more than you should have yours shed without just cause. And yet the culture today, instead of answering the question, what is the unborn, changes the subject. And let me give you Exhibit A on this. Pastor John Pavlovitz is a blogger who writes voluminously at the Huffington Post, sometimes at the New York Times and other publications. He has a message to all of you that call yourselves pro-life. In an op-ed piece entitled, "My Dear White Caucasian Pro-Life Friends, I Wish You Really Were Pro-Life," he writes the following. "I wish you really were pro-life, my friend, I really do. You'd want to do more than prevent abortions. You'd want to prevent hunger and poverty. You'd want to prevent illiteracy and child mortality and forced prostitution. You'd want to prevent racism, and you'd want your kids to have good schools, but you'd also want the poor kids to have good schools. You'd want to support single parents and the terminally ill, and you'd want people of color not to have to fear law enforcement and not be disproportionately incarcerated. You'd want fewer guns in the hands of kids and criminals and those with mental illness. You'd want a living wage for all people who work hard and universal health care for their children so they won't have to give up meals to get health care. My dear pro-life friends, I wish you really were pro-life." Can I translate for you what you just heard? Because you oppose the intentional killing of an innocent human being, you are responsible for everything that is wrong with society. Now, to see how crazy this is, imagine saying to the American Cancer Society, you have no right to call yourself a healthcare organization when you're not fighting lupus, Crohn's disease, heart disease, diabetes, and the list would go on and on. That would be a ridiculous charge, but this is precisely what's being said to pro-life Christians. Or imagine this, a Christian ministry opens an inner city daycare center so that mothers who work in the inner city can finish up their jobs in the afternoon and get home and make supper for their kids before all the kids come home. The daycare center is only open, though, from 3 to 5 school days in the afternoons. Would anybody in their right mind look at that ministry and say, well, if you really cared about kids, you'd be open 24/7? Why are you not open on weekends? Why are you only caring for inner city kids? And what about college students who might need some help? Well, that would be crazy. And yet that's precisely what's being said to the pro-life movement today. Doctors in ER rooms across the world will take drug-addicted patients off the streets, save their lives, and yet release them back onto the streets where many of them will do it again. Does anybody attack the doctor for doing the best he can to save the immediate life of the patient in front of him? Only you, as pro-lifers, get attacked this way. And what's happening in our culture, men and women, and you need to be aware of this, the very definition of what pro-life is now up for grabs. It is subtly changing from being about protection for life in the womb to becoming quality of life for those outside the womb. And if you are not aware of that subtle shift that's happening, even among some Christian circles, you will be swept away and you will not keep the main thing, the main thing. And you will take on a job description that is so backbreaking, not even Superman could pull it off. I think we have a better way as Christians. As Christians, we care about a wide array of issues. Yes, we should do something about sex trafficking. Yes, we should do something about poverty. Yes, we should do something about inner city conditions that lead to crime. Yes, we should do something about refugees. But men and women, hear this. It does not follow that because my Christian ethic is wide, that the operational objectives of the pro-life movement must be wide. That would bankrupt our movement. I mean, what are pro-lifers supposed to do? Spend Monday fighting abortion, Tuesday fighting sex trafficking, Wednesday fighting drug addiction, Thursday fighting the refugee crisis, and Friday immigration control? I mean, this is insane. I got a better way for us. We're going to be essential pro-life Christians who do just three things. Not a million things, not a whole host of things, just a few things. And here they are. Number one, essential pro-life Christians communicate an essential case for life. And every one of you today are going to leave chapel knowing how to do that in a minute or less. Secondly, essential pro-life Christians convey an essential gospel to those wounded by abortion. And thirdly, essential pro-life Christians make essential sacrifices where it counts the most. Our culture wants to take all these other issues and lump them together as being morally equivalent to abortion, as if somehow not getting a big enough paycheck is morally equivalent to being dismembered in the womb. And if Mr. Pavlovitz thinks that, his moral compass is broken. We have a better way. God puts a special emphasis on the lives of the unborn because God is very clear in the Old Testament that child sacrifice is particularly egregious to him. So therefore, we're going to put our emphasis there. Let's talk about the first thing we do. Essential pro-life Christians communicate an essential case for life. When we drive home from Cedarville back to Atlanta, we're going to drive by Bowling Green, Kentucky. Now, how many of you know what car is made in Bowling Green, Kentucky? Do any of you know? Corvette. Now, interesting, my father-in-law, who's 84, he buys new Corvettes somewhat regularly. He surfs, he skis, he drives Corvettes, he rides his horse. He's a crazy guy. But you know what that man did? Two summers ago, he gave my wife his last Corvette. I love him. We're going to drive by where they're made. Now, let's suppose we all took a journey to Bowling Green, Kentucky, and we're watching the assembly of a Corvette. We're seeing where they first put the two plates together, and we follow the process all the way till that car rolls off the assembly line. Would we say that we've got a Corvette when the first two metal plates are put together? No. I mean, those metal plates could be used to build a barbecue, a boat, a chain rail, who knows? Would we say we've got a Corvette when the drivetrain and suspension are in place? Some of you are going, well, now we're getting close. I mean, hey, that motor with 480 horsepower, yeah, I mean, we're getting close. How about this? What about when the body, that fiberglass body, is attached to the frame and the drivetrain and the suspension? Do we have a Corvette then? Some of you are still skeptical. How about this? What about when the tires hit the ground? Do we have a Corvette then? Now I think we all agree we've got a vet. Nobody here is going to say we've got the Corvette when the first two metal plates come together. But you know what? You're not like a part thing, like a car that's put together bit by bit, bolt by bolt. When you were an embryo, men and women, you did something no constructed thing like an automobile ever did. From the very beginning, from the point of fertilization, you developed yourself from within. In that early embryo is everything that's needed to drive the development forward. The mother isn't making the child develop. That's intrinsic to the early embryo. You are identical to that embryo you once were. You weren't just part of another human being back then. You were already a whole living member of the human family. That's the science of embryology. That's exactly what we're told. But you know what? Science alone doesn't give us everything we need. We also need theology and philosophy. In just a minute, I want you to stare at some people around the room. Don't do it yet. But in just a moment, I'm going to have you do this. And what I want you to do is I want you to look at them. Now, guys, if there's been a cute girl here all semester you've been dying to make eye contact with, this will be your God-sanctified moment to do it. Do not laugh. I met my wife that way. Do you see this ring on my finger? 32 years, baby, so don't laugh. Don't underestimate this, all right? Now, 1, 2, 3, stare. Gentlemen, if you're looking at me, you're looking at the wrong place. Stare. All right. Look back this way. What makes us equal? Are we all physically equal? We're not. If development or physical ability makes us equal, those with more of it have a greater right to life than those with less. Last September, I did something crazy or perhaps suicidal. I'm not sure which. At age 57, I went back to my high school where I played on the high school basketball team, and I played on the alumni team against the current student basketball team. Don't laugh. We beat them by 24 points. And yours truly took one shot. It was a three-pointer, nothing but net, baby. Drain that thing. And three assists and a rebound. Now, I consider that an overwhelming success because my objective for the morning was singular: avoid hospitalization. If I had to go up one-on-one against any of you guys and many of you girls out there right now, I'd get creamed because at 57, I'm no longer quick on my feet. I can still shoot the three, but I can't get open to shoot it because I'm too slow. If value comes to us based on physical ability or development, those of you with more of it have a greater right to life than those who have less. Are we all equally self-aware? Some of you, if you had coffee before coming to chapel, can I see your hands? You had a good shot of caffeine. It's okay if you feel that way. I'm an agnostic until my second cup of coffee in the morning. That's all right, all right? I have probably just assured I'll never come back to Cedarville to speak. If self-awareness gives us value, and you have more of it than me, you have a greater right to life than me, because rights are based on degreed things. You know, there's only one thing we all share equally in this room. As you were looking around, here's the one thing we all share. We all share the same human nature that bears the image of our Maker. And you've either got a human nature or you don't. It doesn't come in degrees. People will say, well, that embryo's just a clump of cells. It doesn't have a human nature like you and me. That's different. That embryo's different. So here's my question. How does it follow? Or how is it possible, I should say, for two human parents to create offspring that isn't human, but later become so? To quote my favorite philosopher, Ricky Ricardo, they have some splainin' to do. There's four differences between you, the embryo, and you, the adult. And when I was here 2 years ago, I went over those with you. I'll do it again today for any of you that weren't here. There's a difference of size, a difference of level of development, a difference of environment, and a difference of degree of dependency. Think of the acronym SLED. You'll remember these four differences. Size, you were smaller as an embryo, but since when does body size determine your value? Men are generally larger than women. Do men deserve more rights than women do? At the last college I was at, a guy said, "Yeah, man," and I said to the crowd, "We now know why that man will never be married." What about level of development? You were less developed as an embryo than you are today, but why does that matter? Men and women, we need to get out of the habit of always accepting the burden of proof. If our critic claims that self-awareness gives us value or level of development, it's not on you to refute them, it's on them to defend their own claim. They made it, they own it, they defend it. How does development make you more valuable? Two-year-old girls do not even have a developed reproductive system yet. Are they less human and valuable than the 21-year-old young woman who does? What about environment, where you were located? You were in the womb, now you're out. But how does where you are determine what you are? If you drove, or I should say, if you traveled at least 700 miles to come to school at Cedarville from where you live, can I see your hands? Oh, wow, that's a lot of you. If a journey of 700 miles didn't change you from one kind of thing to another, how does a journey of 7 inches down the birth canal suddenly transform you from non-human, non-valuable thing we can kill to valuable human being that we can't? And finally, degree of dependency. Sure, you depended on your mother for survival. But since when does dependency on another human being mean that we can kill you? There are cases where infants are born who cannot tolerate formula. They can only tolerate their mother's milk. What would we think of a mother who said, "My body, my choice, the kid depends on me, too bad," and she lets her kid starve to death as she unplugs him? Size, level of development, environment, degree of dependency. Think of that acronym SLED, and you'll remember these four differences. Now, I noticed some of you, as I was going through that, you were taking notes faster than broke people at a Dave Ramsey seminar, and you were probably thinking, where on earth am I going to remember that? I have good news for you. At our web, that was a bad joke. At our website, prolifetraining.com, you can get that information, that SLED acronym, prolifetraining.com. But there's another problem we face, men and women. Although our case is strong, we have people who want to make abortion just one of many issues, and they treat it as a mere choice, a preference. How do we reach them? And the answer is we give them a chance to view what's actually at stake. If you saw the movie Saving Private Ryan, can I see your hands? Schindler's List, Hacksaw Ridge. By the way, I met Desmond Doss when I was 11, but that's another story. Dunkirk. Well, the movies I just mentioned, virtually everyone has seen graphic imagery, and you know why you saw it. Though it was disturbing to watch, it conveyed truths that words alone could never convey, and the abortion issue is no different. There are millions of our fellow citizens that will think of it as one issue among many, no different than someone not getting an adequate paycheck. And the reason they think that way, they don't know what abortion is, and they're not going to know until they see it. I'm going to put up on the screen in just a few moments a couple of slides, three slides. They are difficult to view. The first slide will not be difficult. It shows a child in utero. That's easy. That'll be up on the screen 7 seconds. Then there's going to come two more slides that are very difficult to look at. They will be on the screen for 7 seconds each. If you wish not to look at these slides, feel the freedom to look away. If you do look, here's exactly what you'll see. You will see the visual results of a dismemberment abortion, and it is troubling. And I want to say something else. In just a moment, for any of you that are here today that have been wounded personally by abortion, guys who encouraged girls to abort or girls who chose that because you didn't think you had another way out, in just a moment, I'm going to talk about the incredible riches of God's grace found in the gospel when we talk about that essential gospel. But I want you to know, we're not showing this, and Dr. White made this point very clear. We're not talking about abortion today or showing these images to beat up on people, because grace is there for you. And I want you to keep that in mind as we take just a moment to look at this brief visual presentation, and then I'll wrap up quickly with the rest of what I have to say. So at this point, we will go ahead and roll those slides, and if you wish to look away again, you feel the freedom to avert your gaze during the brief moments that this presentation runs. At the end of World War II, there was a remarkable exchange that took place between Dwight Eisenhower, the Allied commander, and his aide, who happened to be Jewish. The Jewish aide began badgering Eisenhower, "You need to go see one of the death camps," and Eisenhower would hear none of it. He said, "I'm too busy prosecuting a war. I don't have time for this." And Eisenhower just kept putting the aide off, and the aide would not back off. And if you've been to the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C., you may remember that as you start on the third level and wind your way down, at the very top, there's this engraving of Dwight Eisenhower sitting in the Jeep with a very pale look on his face. That is because, finally, the Jewish aide convinced him to go look at one of the camps. And just to get rid of the aide, to get him to quit bugging him, Eisenhower said, "Fine, I'll go look at one of your camps." And the aide drove him out to Ohrdorf, a notoriously brutal camp that had just been liberated. Eisenhower got out of the Jeep, and he didn't believe when he got there that the evil was that bad. He was like people today who think abortion's not that bad. It's just one of many issues. He didn't believe the stories. He gets out of the Jeep. He walks in behind a couple of buildings, looks into one of the so-called dorms, comes out, ducks behind a building, and when he quit throwing up finally, he walked back to the Jewish aide, shaken, and he said, "You get every company commander on the phone with me within 50 miles of this place. I'm told the American soldier doesn't know what he's fighting for. When he sees this, he'll know what he's fighting against." If that Jewish aide had the courage to keep the main thing, with a supreme Allied commander, you and I need the courage to keep the main thing, with the friends and people that we're around. That's our job, men and women. There's a second thing we do. We communicate an essential gospel. Pro-life Christians communicate or convey an essential pro-life gospel. Every worldview has to answer two questions. What's wrong with us? And what's the fix? Feminist Katha Pollitt, who wrote the book Pro, Reclaiming Abortion Rights, argues that the problem with culture today is we're apologizing for abortion and we need to stop apologizing for it. According to Pollitt, vacuuming out your house is morally equivalent to vacuuming out your womb. There's no difference between the two. And what's wrong with our world, she said, is that we're ashamed to say that abortion's fine. Stop apologizing for it. The Christian worldview has a different answer. The Christian worldview, based in Scripture, says that every one of us in this room is disqualified. Now, why is that important? Because there are men and women, maybe some of you listening to me right now, you're looking back over your past lives, and you're sitting here at Cedarville University, and you're thinking, the Lord will never be able to use me the way he's using those around me, because if the people around me knew what was back there in my past, they would shudder. Men and women, Jesus doesn't shudder over your sin. He knows it. He doesn't shudder. He paid for it. The gospel is that every one of us is disqualified. I don't know how many of you saw the movie Unforgiven with Clint Eastwood. It's a dark Western. Clint is a gunfighter, an assassin, and he's been training an understudy, a young guy by the name of the Schofield Kid. And the Schofield Kid has just killed his first guy. And he's all excited. "Will, did you see that? I blew them away. Did you see that?" And Clint Eastwood's character, Will Money, looks at the young kid and says, "It's a heck of a thing killing a man, taking away all he ever had and all he ever will have." "But Will, they had it coming, right? They had it coming." And in a line you could preach a month of Sundays on, Will looks at that kid and says, "Boy, we all got it coming." The gospel of Jesus Christ, men and women, is that every one of us in this room has it coming. That's the gospel. In Luke chapter 13, a tower, Jesus describes a tower that falls on people. And his audience expected him to say, "Those people had it coming." And Jesus shocks them with his reply. He says, "If you don't repent, you too will perish. That's the stark reality for every one of us here today. Now, thankfully, God did not leave it to us to fix that problem. Because Jesus comes and bears in full the judgment we deserve, and God proves that his sacrifice is sufficient for our sin by raising Jesus from the dead, bodily and historically, so that all those who trust in Jesus for salvation, God the Father is no longer your judge, he's your dad, and he adopts you into his family as a dearly loved child. You know what this world needs out there, men and women? They need us to tell the truth about abortion. Anybody who tells you the way to spare people guilt is to spare talking about abortion does not know what they're talking about. Because when you don't talk about abortion honestly, you don't spare people guilt, you spare them healing. Unconfessed sin has them out of full fellowship with their Savior. We need to tell the truth about the condition of all of us here, and then point people to the only remedy that can fix things, the gospel of Jesus Christ, our slain Savior, who bore in full the judgment every one of us deserves. I end with this. The essential pro-life Christian makes essential sacrifices. Let me tell you what your first sacrifice needs to be. You need to know how to step up and make your case for life very quickly, very concisely, without any kind of fluff. And I'm going to tell you how to do that in a minute or less. I want you to pretend it is next Thanksgiving. Do any of you have relatives who do not know Jesus, who are not Christian, who are not pro-life, probably not politically aligned with you either, but they visit your home during the holidays? Can I see your hands? Oh, a lot of us. I want you to pretend that you have an Aunt Betty. Aunt Betty is from Boston. And Aunt Betty, Harvard educated, thinks that your Christianity is really weird. And she thinks that Cedarville University is probably weird. And she thinks your pro-life views are really weird. And as she's biting her turkey, she looks at you with a quizzical eye and says, "Now, tell me why you're pro-life. Here is what you're going to say, and I need somebody to time me. Does somebody have a watch that can time me on this?" Okay, you're on, sir. When I say go, you start the clock going. Here's what you're going to say in 1 minute or less. Go. "Aunt Betty, I'm pro-life because the science of embryology says that from the earliest stages of development, you were a distinct, living, and whole human being. You weren't part of another human being like skin cells on the back of my hand. You were already a whole living member of the human family, even though you had yet to grow. And you know what else, Aunt Betty? There's no essential difference between that embryo you were and the adult you are today that would justify killing you back then. Differences of size, level of development, environment, and degree of dependency are not good reasons for saying we could kill you then, but not now." Did I get that done in under a minute? Okay, I did. Now, I may be slow on the basketball court, but I rocked it right there, okay? Men and women, your job is to go out there and clearly articulate what our view is, keeping the main thing the main thing. You are not called to take on every issue under the sun as a pro-lifer. As a Christian, you are called to take on a wide array of issues, but your pro-life objectives are not compromised because you keep the main thing the main thing. And that soundbite keeps the main thing the main thing. And our world needs clarity, and yes, you will take some heat for it. And in that moment, men and women, you will have to make a decision. Do I care more about what my king thinks of me or what that critic standing across the table thinks of me? I hope you'll choose to serve your king. Go out there and serve him. Go out there and give him heaven. God bless you. Thank you for being at chapel today.